BAI buddies to sign up during the show. And that's what I need five of you to do now. Let me be clear. No one in management has told me to get five BAI buddies or else. But if you were them, what would you do? Wouldn't you feel obligated to run programs that get people to donate instead of programs that don't? So if you want to keep What's the Frequency, Kenneth, on BAI, the best way to do that is to help keep BAI on the air. And the best way to do that is to become a BAI buddy. And you can do it in the name of What's the Frequency, Kenneth? So give to WBAI.org. That's give, the number two, WBAI.org, and become a BAI buddy. Sign up to donate $10 a month for the next 12 months. And let the station know that you value What's the Frequency, Kenneth, or Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. In other words, programs you can't hear anywhere else in New York City, and few places outside New York City. Go to give to WBAI.org and become a BAI buddy. Thanks. See you next week, maybe.
Listening for a long, long time, from Democracy Now! To the late and great Armand DeMille. I'm really appreciative on the fact that I'm on the revolutionary radio station right now in New York City.
I'm Josh Fox, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, Revolution Radio.
Revolution Radio. That means that we are spinning. Your mic ain't on yet. That means that we're spinning umpteen times every second. Okay, let me. I don't even know what number your mic is.
Who knows?
Try that again.
We're hamster wheeling it.
That seems right. He said without listening. Talk again.
Okay, I'll put my thing on. Oh yeah, I'm not there. We're hamster wheeling it.
Okay, say that again.
Revolution Radio means you're hamster wheeling
it. Nope, now.
Revolution Radio means you're hamster wheeling it. That's it right
there.
That's
it. Now I got it.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah, so for some reason that's mic five.
Really? Well, because it goes up.
Well, let's see. One, two, three, four, five.
Yay!
It actually works.
The great Jim Freund, not only does he know radio and all kinds of literary things, but he also is a numbers man. What more do you want?
Yeah, well, if somebody would give me numbers and would put me on mic, that would help. But at any rate, let's, you know, pretend that we are quasi-professional and you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, webcasting at WBAI.org, and video casting on Facebook Live in the Hour of the Wolf group.
So we're casting multicasting.
We are multicasting. Having said that, let's howl. We'll be right back. good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. I am Jim Freund. With me is Anthony Sloan. We'll explain who he is in case you didn't already know. And we are going to be, I don't know, shooting the breeze and paying homage to the number 42, Jackie Robinson, and other things. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. If you watch enough SF film, it becomes obvious that the genre loves to portray the future through the lens of the past. Star Wars is the most glaring example, but think about all the glimpses into what's to come that assume the trappings of a noir thriller, or that Terry Gilliam's Brazil posits a tomorrow where people literally strive to live in the memories of a cinema yesterday. And then think about this. Pretty much any new, unexplored phenomenon gets likened to the Wild West, the internet, Twitter, whatever hellish foodstuff KFC is whipping up in its kitchens. The new Brazilian film Bacurau, which opens next week at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and which Terry Gilliam had nothing to do with, is set several years in the future, in the tiny, isolated, close-knit village of Bacurau. But you could easily mistake it for a political rewrite of Tombstone. It's implied rioting is going on throughout the country. A giant video screen celebrates the assassinations of their local outlaw. Their a-hole of a mayor, whose stature is indicated by traveling around with an even bigger video screen, and who actually doesn't live in the village, but that doesn't stop him from swooping in on occasion to try to woo the villagers' votes with expired foodstuffs before carting off a local prostitute who's never seen again, has cut off their water supply, and following the death of the town matriarch, the village starts disappearing off Google Maps, the power is cut off, and individuals begin to be picked off by a group of American mercenaries. Certain analogies sprung to my mind while I was watching Bacurau, particularly during the film's final act, when the history of the village pulls more into focus. Vietnam, First Blood, and weirdly those Eli Roth films where dumb Americans stumble into situations they are not at all prepared for. But directors Juliano Dornelles and Kleber Mendoza Fio are not shy about pointing to John Carpenter, and specifically his Assault on Precinct 13, as prime inspirations, all the way to putting the director's name on the village's school. By the way, I had to find that out by reading the film's listing in IMDb, so don't be too impressed. But the directors give the film its own distinct flavor, from gradually filling in the details of the outlaw status of Bacurau and its inhabitants, to a moment when the villagers mourn their dead and gird for war by staging a surprisingly joyous celebration. Hey, it's Brazil. If your house falls into a sinkhole, you celebrate. Bacarau the Movie presents political satire reformed as science fiction, Wild West action film allegory, and does a better job with it than Outland ever did. The sun-parched mise-en-scene is great. There are tons of engaging characters. Sonia Braga shows up as the town's sardonic doctor. And the third act casts the big final showdown within an interesting ceremonial framework. For all the darkness of its subtext, Bacarau is surprisingly beguiling, a small-scale vision of revolt with a heart of gold. And since Jim Freund has been figuratively tackling anyone who draws near him and exhorting them in no uncertain terms to see a Shaun the Sheep movie, Farmageddon, well, I've seen it, and I can confirm it's a sweet, funny claymation adventure in which the titular sheep helps an impetuous, bunny-eared alien phone home while all hell breaks out around them. If you know the British studio Aardman Animations, most notably from stuff like the Wallace and Gromit features, where Shaun the Sheep made its debut, or the Creature Comforts TV series, you know pretty much how things will go, with lots of weird beats. The best sequence overall is when the alien explores a supermarket, and lots of impertinent humor at the expense of us silly humans. The B story focuses on how the farmer who puts up with Shaun's antics tries to capitalize on alien mania by staging his own jerry-rigged first contact pageant. I did like that the only truly coherent dialogue is the gibberish spouted by the alien. Everybody else expresses themselves with grunts and nicely animated body language. It is unfortunate, I think, that Aardman appears to have abandoned its more experimental and dramatic sides. I don't think we'll be seeing stuff like Going Equipped and the original Creature Comforts, which was actually about more than zoo animals complaining about their surroundings, again. But a Shaun the Sheep movie, Farmageddon, is about as enjoyable a family-friendly E.T. send-up as one could find. And let me just announce that my YouTube project, Historama 3D, has just premiered its first feature film, Gamera 3D, The Goodman Cut, based on the Giant Turtles debut feature. You can watch it in VR for the full 3D experience, or using red-blue anaglyph glasses for the old-school cheapo 3D effect. Just go to YouTube VR, or just plain YouTube and search for Historama 3D, all one word, no dashes necessary. And if you have fun, please like and subscribe. More is coming soon. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. I missed what you were saying because I was so hung up with a couple of things, including Gamera. I think it's Gamora, like I and Gamora by Samuel R. Delaney, you know.
Everybody else could have talked about the Avengers or something like that, or rather Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, well, yeah. Now, you see, that I've always had an issue with as well, because when I hear the term...
Gamora?
No, Avengers.
Oh.
I don't think Avengers Assemble. I think Mrs. Peel...
Oh,
you're
Lord,
needed. Those. And you know what?
And Mr. Steele wants Mrs. Peel.
Oh, don't we all? Even today, Diana Rigg, you know.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Stop. Hey, leave these people alone.
This woman's in her 80s.
Yeah, that's about your speed.
But let me tell you something. There were two women in my youth who were responsible for my voice going from whatever it was to whatever it may be now. They were Jane Fonda
and
Diana Frigella, Rigg.
And Annette Frigella, whatever her name was, from Mickey Mouse Club?
God, no. Diana Rigg. Yeah. That's class. Jane Fonda, that's political.
Yeah,
but fun. More than political. I need to tell listeners, if you were watching on Facebook Live, the Wi-Fi here, there's a technical term.
Is wanting.
Sucks.
Oh.
Is the technical term. And so rather than go on and off and on and off,
it just be relocated.
We are recording the event. Yeah. With Anthony Sloan as guest.
That would be me.
And when I get home at about 4 a.m., I will upload the video. This is Anthony's idea, which is a great idea. Wow. I'll upload the video onto Facebook and YouTube.
Oh, that'd be good.
Oh, yeah. Because you have an audience on YouTube.
Well, I don't have an audience on YouTube.
But I have a
site on YouTube.
You have a site on YouTube.
Yeah, you can send me. Well, that's fine. That means I can see it.
Okay. So who am you?
This is the interesting thing. Remember we were talking earlier when you took me, when you actually bought me some food, you know?
Yeah.
At the hollow nickel thing where the spy was and all the rest of that.
Yeah.
The artist spy and all the rest of that.
Yeah, the artist spy. Mark Rylance played him in the movie.
And we were saying.
Got the Academy Award, too.
Oh, good. I have to see that movie.
It's a great movie. Mm. Coen Brothers. Spielberg can go either way. Coen Brothers have never made a really bad movie.
Yeah.
And they wrote it. They didn't make the film. They didn't direct it. But they wrote it. And it's a great screenplay.
Yeah, well, I'm only into when they did Blood Simple, so I'm sorry. After that,
It makes me queasy. You don't like Fargo?
Yeah, I love Fargo.
Well,
I'm just saying, I stopped at the Blood Simple. That's all I'm trying to say.
Okay, yeah. nothing wrong with that. Do you think that's her best movie today?
No,
date?
I don't think that. I'm just saying that's it for me.
Well, what
let's not get into it. Let's go back to what I was saying. Right?
Who am you?
I'm trying to tell you. I was riding in a conveyance. You know, as we're going from King Williamstown, which is, you know, like where Steve Biko was, up to Alice, you know, where Fort Harry is. That's where all the struggles.
Oh, you're talking about South Africa.
Exactly. You know South Africa because you watch The Birds from South Africa, you know.
I'm aware, as nobody can see, unless I go around on camera, I am wearing the shirt.
Yes, you are.
I am.
Anyway.
Safari Live, now called Wild Earth. It's been rebranded.
Oh, that sounds all right.
Well, Wild Earth is the company that owns Safari Live, but National Geographic, which was sponsoring Safari Live, no ads or anything, but they were giving the money so they could get the footage and stuff. They pulled their support, and so now they're trying different things. So they changed the name from Safari Live to the corporate name Wild Earth. Oh. But it's on YouTube as we speak for another 15 minutes.
Shouldn't it be like Bird Earth or something like that?
No, it's more about lions and there are some people. They just had a bird weekend where they went and they counted as many birds as they could find in 72 hours. Answer, by the way, 138.
Right.
That's not birds. That's different species, right?
Okay.
But there are people there. All they care about is seeing a leopard sleeping in a tree, you know, and then talking about that. They know the entire genealogy of every cat, the different prides, the different lion coalitions. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't name the wildebeest, a.k.a. news. Why they have two names, I don't know. They never explain that. They call them wildebeest, but here in the United States, we call them gnus.
Okay.
At any rate, Safari Live or Wild Earth, right now either name works.
Hmm.
It's on in the U.S. at 9 a.m. On the East Coast from 9 a.m. till noon. Is the evening drive, because we are, after all, talking South Africa.
Yeah, we're seven. South Africa is 7 hours ahead of the United States East Coast.
And they're in Juma, which is part of the Kruger National Park, which is what, about 1,000 miles from where you live? Alice, I think it's about.
And
you're southeast.
Yeah, I'm in Eastern Cape, yeah.
Yeah.
Southeast of that.
Southeast of
the Kruger National Park.
Of the Kruger National Park, which is where they are. And then in the evenings, they're on currently from 10:30 p.m. till 1:30 a.m. So they're on live 6 hours a day. People never believe they're live.
Why?
Well, because you take a look and you watch these people who are like in the midst of a herd of elephants. And you say, when did they film that? And they allow you to contact them via Twitter or YouTube chat. And so somebody types in there and saying, Johnny O says, this isn't live. They're lying. And then the person in the Jeep says, no, Johnny O, We're here. We just saw your text. So Johnny O has a small, like,
I'm going to say who I am. I'm going to introduce myself because the first thing I had in radio, I was the poet in residence for WPRB Radio, the Saturday Soul with JB at WPRB, which is the Princeton radio station.
Right.
From 1972, 73, 74. But I was poet in residence. So I started out my little thing as a poet on radio and community radio, if you want to put it that way. Here's a poem I just wrote.
That you just wrote.
When I said yes, I mean, I just came up here from Cape Town. I'm going to read it. You can't. You want to read it?
No. I want you to. No.
You can read it.
I want to read it. Why are you talking like Samuel Jackson at me? You read it.
Okay.
And may I say, by the way, that Samuel Jackson is one of my favorite media personalities in the world.
He's absolute favorite for me.
Yeah.
The title of
I have a few, so.
Yeah, but don't worry, it's not a profound poem or anything like that, but you mentioned birds, and it just happened to be birds. Let me tell you what happened.
You mentioned birds, but go ahead.
Okay, that's fine, I mentioned birds. Switching this thing around. No, coming up here, I live in Dallas, but I fly out of Cape Town, so I know people, because I lived in Cape Town for like 10 years or something like that, so I have no people there, so I was visiting a friend of mine, and he happened to just move to a new place, and there's like nothing in front of him, just open space. Now, if anybody knows Cape Town, it was the last thing that was settled, because they went to Stellenbosch first, because they couldn't handle the Cape, because there's two oceans that meet, Indian Ocean and Atlantic Ocean,
right.
And then you have the mountains, so you have this tremendous wind all the time. It just happened last time I was here. Wind was blowing so hard. Glass was falling out of windows, whatever have you.
Now, you don't get tornadoes, or you get monsoons, right?
No, we don't get monsoons. Yeah.
What do you get? What's
wind.
You get wind. But you get pretty, you can have, and there was a drought, at least Kruger.
Yes, there was
a drought. But that broke recently.
Yeah, there was a drought last year, and cows were falling over and all the rest of that stuff.
Yeah, no, there's a drought in Kruger for about 5 years. And this season, it is rain.
Yes.
And while it makes it very hard for the people in Jeeps going out looking at animals, they are so happy.
Don't get stuck in the mud.
They call that the Marshmallow Club. When you're sitting on top of the mud,
and the lines are circling.
The white people on top of the mud, it's the Marshmallow Club. The lions are like, they could give a bleep. All they want to do is sleep.
That's right, yeah.
The leopards.
Well.
But you know who are the ones who will come right up to the Jeep and like.
Baboons, man.
No.
Who?
Hyena.
Oh, hyena. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Hyena. They, especially hyena cubs, they practically want to be petted.
Mm-hmm.
They will go right up to the Jeep and try to befriend people. And it's one thing for them to be acclimated to the fact that there are Jeeps there. They're not acclimated to people. They're acclimated to the machinery. But they understand that the pink things inside these metal things sometimes have tourists on them. Tourists have food. And hyenas want nothing but food.
Say that again. The pink things inside
the metal things. Yeah, exactly.
This
is how they describe themselves.
I'm not going to tell people the inside joke of that. Let me get back to what I was saying. I was in Cape Town.
Yes.
And the wind is tremendous there, right? But anyway, so I was looking out this window, it's a big view, and the birds are just flying like there's no wind. And so I wrote this poem. That was the inspiration for this poem. You want to hear it?
I'm ready.
Here we go. Title poem is How Do Birds Fly? And then you have the brackets, in the Cape Town wind. Okay? It's a wonderment to see birds. What kind? Fly in the Cape Town wind. As you attempt to stand against such fierceness churned by oceans too, you bend against this seasonal wind, looking skyward occasionally, only to witness the air beings in effortless flight, perhaps even looking down on your plight. You know you are you, they are they, entanglement is not possible. Written by the poet Anthony. That would be me, Anthony Sloan, or Anthony J. Sloan, something like that. I don't know. I have a lot of names.
Yeah.
That's
for
it.
A while, you called yourself T. I never got
no,
that.
No, 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 no. That's my radio. That's my nom de voce.
That was
de
your
voce.
Radio designation.
No, that's my nom de voce. I still use it.
Your nom de voce.
That's
okay.
Right.
Very good.
T from the Pattersons taking a train to Tibet. It comes from a longer poem that was inspired by, wait for it, Stormy Monday.
Ooh.
Which aired on Fridays, but...
when you say Stormy Monday, you're referring to David Jackson and...
James Brown.
And James Brown, no relation to the singer.
James Brown with an E at the end of it.
Yeah, who did a brilliant radio show first here and then later on WBGO.
Actually, no, only James went to BGO as a DJ, as a jazz whatever.
Right.
Dave was more the literary person. He didn't really, I don't think he ever really went with him there.
Really?
No, I
thought he did. Well, no. one way or the other, Stormy Monday, which was on Fridays.
Let me tell you, when we had the folio,
I
wrote the copy for No More Radio, I said, arguably, the third best program on radio, the first being Stormy Monday. You picked the second.
Me?
No. That's what. That
oh,
was the
oh you're saying
that,
to
that,
people.
That was my copy in the
oh,
photo.
Oh, I see. Right. Said, you no, picked the
said,
second.
It said No More Radio. Arguably, the third best program on radio, Stormy Monday being the first.
Okay. My second?
You picked the second. Okay,
my second was the show that preceded this. It was What's the Frequency, Kenneth, with Paul Fisher.
Oh, I didn't know that one. No,
it
was before my time.
You know Paul Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
News director of WBAI from 1967 through...
Oh, the Vietnam guy.
No, well, did Paul... No, I think that was Neil Conan.
Ah, Neil, you're
went to Vietnam, but Paul was the anchor here.
Yeah.
Paul was the one who hired the weekend... news person by name of Margot Adler. But Paul was our news director. He was the person, only person to interview Patty Hearst at, you know, during the whole SLN thing. At that point, he was at KPFA.
This is
KPFK.
This is interesting.
He's at one of them. Paul, let me know. Email me.
Because there's all these links. Because there was a doctor, a psychiatrist, whatever have you, that was part of that whole that Simonese Liberation Army thing.
The SLA. You know?
Yeah. And he I met him. He was a psychiatrist, something like that, from Bellevue, whatever. He gave it up because he took a trip when they just gave it up. But he was doing medical work for those guys. Right?
Yeah.
And but I met him in northern Thailand.
Whoa.
He's an expat, his brother was dropped out or whatever. He's just expat, but his brother was a vice president of Chase Manhattan Bank.
Okay. Well, I was an assistant vice president at Citibank, so that doesn't
poor baby
impress me that much.
Poor baby,
it doesn't sorry, mean anything. Baby. There's only four titles in banks: assistant manager, manager, assistant vice president, and president and flunky.
Hmm.
So it's only five. That's true. That's true.
Hmm.
And I was an assistant manager, which is the same thing, same ranking as a branch manager.
Hmm.
In your local bank. What did that mean? It meant that I ran a computer network for a private group within the bank.
If you were slick enough, then maybe Barack Obama would have hired you because he hired all those other city bankers.
That might have been, except we were an interface design group. We had nothing to do with banking whatsoever.
Anyway, that's who I am. I'm a poet.
You're a poet. You were arts director of this radio station.
That's an administrative job.
You produced a number of bizarre live radio dramas.
Profound live radio dramas.
How profound is The Phantom Tollbooth? Do you know they're remaking the movie?
Well, no, I didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Ours were the best. That was so much fun.
It was incredible. Did not care for the movie Chuck Jones. I love Chuck Jones. Although he gave the final credit to Abe Levitow.
What, the cartoonist Chuck Jones?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
He made a movie of The Phantom Tollbooth. Hmm. But basically he was no longer really animating for Warner Brothers. So Abe Levitow got the directing credit on the film. But everybody worked on the film was trained by Chuck Jones, who oversaw the movie as a supervisory producer. But it.
We did that at New York Shakespeare Festival.
We did it at the Public Theater.
Yeah, of course.
And the director of the Public Theater at that time was Kevin Kline.
That's right. He is co with whoever the other person was.
He was the name person. He was the person who went on the letterhead.
Yeah, exactly.
So they could say, we have this great actor. Mm. And we were doing it in Martinson Hall, which no longer exists as a space. They've redesigned the whole thing into different spaces, including Joe's Pub and stuff like that. But we were in Martinson Hall, and we were rehearsing. I remember very well Delphine Blue in a bee outfit. She was a bumblebee.
Yeah.
I was, what role did you give me? I think I was Alec, the half boy.
Something weird. All I know is, was it Charlie French who was the dog?
Matthew.
No, it was Charlie French.
Charlie Finch. They're
cousins. Charlie Finch, the art curator, whatever have you. He had a program. He was, believe me, because he was the big guy.
Yes.
With the flaps going down.
I remember that. Well, and Delphine wore like this bumblebee shirt. I have photos to prove it.
Oh, Lord.
So anyhow, I went to the back of the theater to hear how the acoustics were, and there was nobody else in the theater except like three seats away. I looked to my right. There's a guy eating his lunch. It was Kevin Kline.
Hmm. Oh, so he saw our rehearsal?
Yes.
We never rehearsed, really. We just walked through it one time. And then
you made us be there. We were there at least two times on set.
Oh.
We didn't really have blocking.
Blocking with the microphone. How could you either you're on mic or you're not?
Well, yeah, but it was also on a stage in a theater.
True. That's true.
So let's see. Now you did Phantom Tollbooth. I'm not talking about the readings, the marathon readings you did, because of course those Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison.
I don't know if they did. No, I never did Invisible Man because I don't like that book. No, the audio dramas I did. Okay, I never did readings.
I thought you did.
No, that's somebody else.
Like Ralph Ellison?
No, you understand. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man is a great book. Okay, but it's not my kind of book. I was a Richard Wright guy and a Henry Dumas guy. So what we did The Long Dream.
Right.
The big one we did that was an amazing, the 8.5 hour live audio drama we started at New York Post Cafe with it, was The Outsider. Where I adapted
absolutely, I remember.
I adapted his first book wasn't published. Was Lord Today. I took Lord Today and The Outsider. Outsider is absolutely my favorite book of all time, and I made it into one audio drama. It started in the '50s.
Mm-hmm.
It was an amazing experience. It was amazing, and the script was like thick. I mean,
one of the things you did, which was very rare. Was you didn't bring in like actors from here, there, and everywhere. You used the WBAI staff, whether they were in the news department or public affairs or in the subscriptions department. You used the assets of the radio station.
Well, that was when, here's what happened. Before I became arts director, remember, I started really doing audio dramas live in like 86 or something like that because I had my core group, Creative Unity.
Right.
So if you look at my resume, most of the things we did were like, let's call it, black orientated. You know what I mean? Black themes like that. And then when I became arts director, that was after The Outsider.
Mm.
Then because I was arts director, I had to deal with the entire station. And I used audio drama to bring the entire station together.
Right.
It was a therapy. That's why I used only people in the station. And the first one we actually did was Animal Farm. Talk about Delphine.
Right.
Talk about Delphine. The most beautiful thing was Andrew Phillips and Delphine. They did this song in the beginning. It was so beautiful. I can't explain. It was so beautiful.
Do you have an air check of that?
I don't know. I'm supposed to be looking at. I don't know. Somebody has it someplace. I don't know.
Maybe.
I have lost so much of my radio.
I had a flood in my house, and all my 10-inch reels are gone. That's 30 years of radio.
Well,
because the splices came off. It wasn't just you. So the And I was using what they called in those days rainbow reels. A rainbow reel is when you take a 10-inch reel and you take the leftover segments from 7-inch reels and whatever, and you splice them all together. Well, you put that into a flood, and the splices come off. The labels saying what it is.
Let me go back to Adam Fofo. You know who played Boxer? Playthel Benjamin was Boxer.
Oh my God. Has he ever lived that down?
No, he was, because he didn't rehearse enough like that, but he's good. And, you know, everybody's good. Come on, huh?
Yeah.
You know, when you do one of my audio dramas, you're good. You got to be good. I make you good. You know why? Because you only get one shot. Your adrenaline be pumping, and you got to do it.
Oh, yeah. You had the adrenaline going.
Oh,
I was not well rehearsed when I performed in the Phantom Toll Booth, but I had
fun.
One of the best times of my life doing that. It was great.
That's what I'm saying.
It's all embedded. What year are we talking about?
Phantom was maybe was 93. I don't know. 92.
Whoa, 93. I thought it was even older than that.
No, somewhere in there, because I was art director from 91 to 96, and that's when I did the stuff there. Like, for instance, we did the Alice stories, you know?
Yes.
That was amazing because I had three narrators. I had two narrators, inner voice of Alice, you know, like her thoughts.
Right.
So that was another actor, right? And then Alice herself, which is by Victoria Starr was Alice. She played Alice,
mm-hmm.
right? But the Red Queen was Michio Kaku.
Oh, my duck.
And we used his theme. Now, the reason why I say that is because out of all experience, this is why I respect Michio so much. In rehearsal, you could tell people, right? Michio, he talking about discipline. He just did it. You know, he just studied the thing and one time and just hit it. So you know, it's like I can't explain. You know, other people have questions and blah blah, and you're trying to da da. I don't know. I had a really good time, but I still do audio drama. But I use it for different things now.
Yeah, but now you're doing now it's not the voice of Alice. Now it's the city of Alice.
I work with a group. I live in a village actually. I live in a place called Limbete. Well, in Alice, but Alice.
But it's right. It's a suburb of Alice.
Yeah,
and Alice is named after Theodore Roosevelt's niece?
Nah, I don't know about that. I don't think so. This is the English thing. Maybe it is.
No. This is the way the history.
Go look it up. I didn't know.
This is the way the history books have it. Is that it's a relation to Theodore Roosevelt?
Really?
Yes, absolutely. Wow. And everybody in Theodore Roosevelt's family was named Alice except Eleanor, but I mean in his actual blood family, his mother's grandmother, his daughter.
Well, the colonists can say what they want, but what we've called the autochthonous name, the real name is Edikeni. Edikeni.
Edikeni.
Edikeni.
Okay. Yeah.
E-D-I-K-E-N.
You see, on my favorite TV show, which you're talking about, which ended 6 minutes ago, Safari Live, or Wild Earth, if you prefer, they're in a small reserve inside, right outside Kruger National Park, adjacent to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in this very small area, which is, they talk about the hectares. I don't know from hectares.
Hectares like acres, the amount of
land. Well, X many acres make up a hectare.
Yes, yes.
And I barely understand what an acre is. But, yeah, let's say it's something like 5 miles square, okay? Mm-hmm. In that small area, they have three languages.
Well.
Three local languages.
Yeah.
And bless them for making sure that as long as it's possible, they try to hire people.
Locals
from those languages. Most of the presenters tend to be either white or else have enough elocution
mm-hmm.
so that an American audience doesn't have to strain too hard to hear them. And when they were up in the Masai Mara, which you're going to be doing again during the so-called Great Migration.
That's up near Kenya.
Yes, it's in Kenya in the Rift. What do you call where you have the two mountain ranges in the middle. Well, it's called the Maasai.
Yeah,
are the main people who live there, and the Mara is the name of the place. And there's the River Mara that crosses near the north of that, and that is famously the place where the wildebeest and zebra forge a river, and where the crocodiles and lions are just waiting for a feast, for a buffet.
Right.
And they have a guy there named David who is a local. Mm-hmm. And this is a guy who bridges the cultures so well, because he dresses in and speaks as much in his culture. He will sing songs. He will tell stories. He will do things. And your jaw just drops and you say, because he's able to communicate to people in the U.S., mm-hmm. you realize just how rich the culture is. Then you have some other people that are locals who will insist, if you eat this particular plant, your wife will be very happy that night. You know, and in fact, those plants are often poison. I mean, this is the so-called traditional medicines are rubbish.
Hmm.
Very often. So far as Western science.
Oh, that's what I was about to say, because sangomas don't be playing. You know what I mean?
Aspirin comes from the bark of a tree.
Yeah.
You know, and that comes from that general neck of the woods.
Well,
you
can get aspirin in Central Park. You can get the bark of the tree in Central Park. You
know? I thought it takes certain specific.
Dr. Moore used to be on NOMA Radio. He used to take people to Central Park. You know, it doesn't matter.
At any rate.
But what languages? Because there's 11 official languages in South Africa. It must be Venda or something like that.
It's not Venda. If I heard the name, there's one that's something like Shibulu.
Huh.
Something like that.
Okay.
I mean, these are very limited villages.
Shona is up Zimbabwe, so.
Shona is north of there, yeah. Because this is South Africa. I don't know what city they're closest to. A lot of the people who work on the show come from Cape Town or J-Town.
Well, no, it's Cape Town's all the way. They just
Cape
come
Town's
to,
all the way south. I know that.
They
I know that.
To work.
It's like 1,000 miles away. I know that.
More like 2,000.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah. But, look, people are going to get bored.
But they commute.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, but it's my favorite show. I obsess over it.
I know.
Anyway.
So, Jim.
Anthony.
This is from the Patterson Technology. That's how we got off on this.
Okay. Before we get off on anything else, as it were, let me tell people that I have advertised that this morning's show will be about the number 42.
Hmm.
And we're going to get there.
Okay.
But Anthony needs to leave here to get to the airport, was it?
I have to get some people to the airport And my homeless brother hangs out at the airport. So I'm
gonna
see
geez.
Him too.
Okay, so you're going to be leaving here in about 45 minutes or so. And we're going to do 42 at that time, which means that tonight we're only going to hear one episode.
Hmm.
And I think I'm going to play the first episode. Usually I play episodes 3 and 4 because they go together. It's actually episode 4 where the number 42 comes into play.
So what are you going to do next week? You're going to do the whole thing?
No. I may wait for – well, first of all, the whole thing is 3 hours.
Oh.
I don't have that time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a fan of episode 6. It's just not that well written. It's not as funny. Episodes 1 through 5, there are two sources for the best science fiction radio drama ever done. One is American and one is British.
Hmm.
And the American one is the work of the Firesign Theater, which came out of Pacifica.
Mm-hmm.
The British one is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Which is what we're going to be talking about tonight.
What is the answer to life, the universe, and everything? And the answer is big theme song, big rumble, and all of the multiverses are waiting.
Crescendo.
And all of that, and the voice announces 42. And so this this week is the 42nd anniversary of the first British broadcast of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
So it was like this week in March, like that?
Yeah. But there's also a date, I don't recall why it's in May, I'm sure some listeners know, that is called Towel Day.
Towel Day.
Yes, because...
Like T-O-W-E-L, what?
Yes, when you are... It's one of the first thing, it's on the cover of the book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Mm. And by that, I mean the fictional book, not the book that Douglas Adams wrote some years after the radio drama. So many people think that Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a book. Well, it became a book, but that's a novelization of a radio series. And I'm talking about the original bona fide radio series, which most people, when you say Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, they say, oh, yeah, I've gotten that on my bookshelf at home.
Or like me, I saw the movie Most Definite.
The movie was not bad. It was a lot better. It was directed by Jay Roach. It was a lot better than the movie that Douglas Adams was going to make.
But Jim.
But he died before it could get made.
But Jim, let's not be humble. Let's give the backstory. Let's go all the way back.
Well, I was going to do that in a while.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You know, when I was going to open it up, possibly even when you were gone. But okay, I'll give the backstory.
No, we started right.
In 1978, not that long after Hitchhikers had played on the BBC, this fellow by the name of Douglas Adams cold called all the Pacifica radio stations. He knew about Pacifica radio because we used to be radio partnered with the BBC.
So Douglas Adams is in England.
Douglas Adams is in England. Mm-hmm. He is the showrunner for a TV show called Doctor Who. The umpteenth season of which is just over. And as a huge Doctor Who fan, may I say that this season was so disappointing.
I've heard that. Everybody's
they had one good episode out of the 10 that they broadcast, and it had a lot of promise for what the arc for the series would have, and then they ended it on a cliffhanger, which has never before happened. The show premiered the same day that Kennedy was shot. That's how old the show is, right? They have never ended a season. Yeah, which and each you get one season a year nowadays. They've never ever done that. They did that this time. I love the new Doctor, Jodie Whittaker. It's a woman now, and there's no reason why not. And there's an alternative Doctor who's a black woman, and they only go so far as to explain her existence because how is it that one Doctor, who has thousands and thousands of years of memory, and the other Doctor, who similarly has been through many multiverses, they never knew about each other. And they never really satisfactorily explain any of that. But that was the fun of that episode, was, ooh, mystery, puzzle and all that. And instead, most of what the script writers came up with fell flat. It was still entertaining to watch because the performances are just so good. Jodie Whittaker as the Doctor is brilliant. She's wonderful.
What else is she famous for?
Broadchurch was a TV series that she did in England. Also with David Tennant, another Doctor from Doctor Who, and with the same writer-producer of the current Doctor Who, Chris Chibnall. And that went three seasons, and the first season was brilliant, and the second season was good, and the third season I've never watched.
Let's go back to what we were talking about.
But she's also famous for stage, you know. She's Shakespearean and all that. So this guy who was the – they didn't use the word showrunner, but he was the lead script editor.
The head writer.
Of Doctor Who. Well, actually, the credit on screen was the one I just gave. In the last year of the fourth Doctor, Tom Baker, and then for the first 3 years of the fifth Doctor, played by Peter Davison. And he knew that we had had this affiliation with the BBC, which meant that we were one of the very few places in the United States who had these proprietary turntables that could play BBC transcription discs. They were on vinyl, and they played just like a record player, but they did not run at 33 and a third. They are at a different speed. If Max is listening, I'm sure he could come in and explain the exact difference. There were also 14-inch discs, where our discs were 12 inches, and so forth. So you had to have the right equipment to play it. And Douglas wanted to promote in the U.S., this radio series that he wrote.
Yeah, smart man.
So he calls up each and every Pacifica radio station, and he calls our station manager, Larry Josephson, Larry the J, and says, you know, I've got this thing I'd like to talk about, and I can talk about the TV series I'm helping run called Doctor Who. And Josephson says, what kind of a show is that? And he explains, well, it's about this Time Lord and all that. Josephson says, stop, it's science fiction. Give it to Jim Freund. And he contacts me and he says, do you want to have this guy from Doctor Who on your show? I'm going, you're kidding me, what? Yes. So Douglas comes to a building that we owned in those days at 359 East 62nd Street.
That's the famous church.
That's the church, capital T, capital C. And we recorded a half-hour interview and then the hell with it. My next show was on a Thursday. I used to be on Monday through Friday, but at that point in history, I was probably wisely cut down by the program director to two shows a week. And on that Thursday, he came on the air live, and we talked about it. And he somehow accidentally, one can guess if it was on purpose or not, left six discs, each one running 32 minutes. Of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. A week later, he went to L.A., and he did the same thing to Mike Hodel, who not only did a great science fiction show there called Hour 25, that's H-O-U-R, 25, he had been a news person here at WBAI, working with Paul Fisher and Margot Adler. And in fact, when I was Margot Adler's co-host on Thursdays and Fridays, intermittently, every so often, Mike Hodel was co-host with her on Mondays. So people, when they say, oh, Mike Hodel did it first, it's like, yeah, he did. If he did Hour 25, he did it on Hour of the Wolf. So, no, not first. Sorry. There's about a three-year difference. At any rate.
We lost. What happened
so
to the 66
Douglas,
this that was
Douglas went from Hour of the Wolf to Hour 25.
Okay.
And he again accidentally left another
six discs.
Somewhere in Wikipedia, you say Mike Hodel died tragically young. I think he was about 49. And it just wasn't fair. And he was a wonderful personality and
a good die young.
Good guy and did great radio. And the L.A. people think that that was like the only science fiction show in the world.
Wow.
And I thought that mine was the only. No, that's not fair because I knew Mike well. We traded recordings and stuff like that. There was a lot of stuff in the BAI archives in the arts department, readings that were done by Mike Hodel that you were probably aware of but just didn't know his name. But at any rate, Douglas came here. He left the discs. Being a two-hour show and each disc being about half an hour, on one day I played three discs, and the next day I played the other three.
Okay.
And that was the first time The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was ever broadcast in the United States.
Okay, hold on a second. Now I'm confused. Did the L.A. 25th hour guy?
24.
Did he play it
hour
first?
Hour 25. He played it a week later.
Okay, that's all I need to know.
And since his show was half an hour. Mm-hmm. He played one episode a week for 6 weeks.
Oh, okay.
I played 3 episodes a day for 2 days.
Right.
So by the time he had broadcast the first episode, I had finished the series.
You were done.
Yeah. But his fans, you know how people work in Wikipedia, and Wikipedia, it says he'd done it first. And as often happens, Wikipedia is wrong. We did it first. But you see, he was a wonderful guy, and I am not going to go to his fans and say, screw you, it was me, not him.
No, well, listen. You just corrected the record. That's fine. But you know what it's like with these fans and everything? Like, it's like the term Foley, you know?
Yeah.
Foley is not, you know, it should be the Aura Nichols or something like that. It should be something like that, because the sound effects from radio, and that's it. Foley was a film guy. And
that's right.
It's just this big time producer just trying to push him, a fan, basically.
But what he did was he standardized what the different tools for a standard sound effects library. Mm-hmm. A practical sound effects. In other words, you're really doing it. You're not just playing recordings.
Yeah. He codified it, the situation. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give him that credit.
Yeah, and it's a good credit. Yeah. So to this, I mean, they still use the term rotoscope. You watch the credits in a Marvel movie on Black Panther for rotoscope, and though that alone, the rotoscope credits take like a minute and a half, filling an entire screen with 3-point type of the various rotoscope artists. Yeah. Rotoscope was something created and invented by and patented by the Fleischers, who did Betty Boop and Popeye and the Superman cartoons. Mm-hmm. And then they were totally ripped off. That's a whole other story.
Yeah, well.
Famous Studios and all that. But so, you know, it's the same kind of a thing. We're calling what they do now, which is totally computer-related, rotoscope, where what it used to be is you had a projector, you had a white sheet. Mm-hmm. You put the projector on pause and projected it onto that white sheet, and the artist would go and then draw what they had on the white sheet. The first subject that they used was Cab Calloway. Because they had to get that moonwalking.
Minnie the Moocher. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, that's the number, not surprisingly, that he did. The first one was Minnie the Moocher. The second one was Old Man of the Mountain. Mm-hmm. Go to YouTube. You can look it up. Great cartoons. Worth watching today and not for kids.
I love Cab. Let me say something about Cab Calloway. Everybody, if I was to compare Cab with any, well, almost contemporary, it would be Prince. To me, Prince was a
Prince for you is everything.
Well, I wouldn't say all that. I'm an appreciator. But
always been like, you know, who's the greatest this or that? Your answer is always Prince.
No, it's not. That's not. No, my greatest answer, I'm a fan of Marvin, but we won't get into all that stuff. Here's the thing. All I'm trying to say, people don't die. Their spirits or their legacy doesn't die. It keeps on going.
Especially not if they were media people.
Yeah, and then plus people have perceptions of you. Like I've been called the Bertolt Brecht of audio drama. I've been called Orson Welles, something like that. But if I would describe myself, I say I'm the Duke Ellington of audio drama. So there you go. It just depends on your orientation, you know.
I guess
it depends how you work. You know what I mean?
I think of Duke Ellington as a classical composer.
I think of him as somebody who brought some elements together and had
Had
the elements work so well
together. I mean, black and tan fantasy, you know, you deal with that stuff. And I dare anybody to say it's this kind of music and not that kind of music. You cannot do it.
Plus he had no boundaries, because one of my greatest, I love Come Sunday, when he got Mahalia Jackson to actually do a secular song. Those are the kind of things that I do. I convince people they should do something they don't normally do. That's what I actually do.
Sat through more than 60 Duke Ellington performances because when I was a bartender at the Rainbow Grill.
You was a bartender at the Rainbow Grill?
I was for 7 years.
Man, I wish I'd known you then.
This is the 70s. Mm-hmm. And actually my main job was cashier in the Rainbow Room, which was a dance club. You know, and when I say dance, think Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
Yeah, real dance.
Had a turntable, had a live orchestra, Cy Oliver and his orchestra.
Cy Oliver.
You know Cy Oliver.
Well, I'm a music director. You know what I'm saying.
Cy is one of the coolest people in the world. He wrote Opus 1 for the Mills Brothers. He created the Mills Brothers. When you listened on the radio in the olden days to the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, the odds were that you were listening to Cy Oliver lead the orchestra. But the moment that Tommy Dorsey was on film, somehow all those people became white. But the actual Cy Oliver Orchestra was the house band for the Rainbow Room. I'm still occasionally in touch with Jeff Oliver, his son.
I'm a little bit confused. Is it Bobby, who else played at the Rainbow Room early on?
Not that many people played the Rainbow Room, but the Rainbow Grill was a nightclub, and the acts there changed every 2 weeks.
Okay, I'm thinking of Rainbow Room. Let me say something.
Rainbow Room is a dance club. Rainbow Grill was a nightclub.
Okay. That's right. Let me say this. I have to say something about, since we are broadcasting over the airways of WBAI Radio in New York.
New York, thank you. 30 seconds early, but we'll take it.
Oh, you can continue if you wish.
Go ahead. That was a station break.
A lot of times people don't understand community radio. They confuse it with public radio or whatever have you. Now, for instance, I was arts director. Now, that doesn't mean anything to anybody, but it also makes me music director. Now, what that means, a music director of a station like this is different than a music director, than any other kind of music director on the planet. If you're the music director of a classical station, well, that's what you do. If you're a hip-hop station or jazz station, whatever have you. A music director of a station like this, my goodness, I got to deal with, you know, opera. I got to deal with, you know, bluegrass. I got to deal.
You got to deal also with live performers.
All these things.
Not just spinning discs.
Yeah. So my musical acumen or my musical knowledge has to necessarily be broader than being a regular program director, a music director of any other station.
I mean, when you get people like James Hersey, Bill Farrar, Jamie Katz, help me, the woman, Marion McPartland.
All these, you know.
These amazing people, and when they do a music show, they're not just spinning discs.
Dave Kenny was listening,
Dave Kenny's what was, maybe still is, well, not now,
I'm just saying, there's so many different people had to deal with. What happens is, the reason why I say, who am I? That kind of thing. I was talking about when I was writing on this thing. Somebody I was talking to a while, he said to me, "Oh, you're a socialist, right?" This was in Alice, you know, these kids. I said, "No, I'm an Anthony. Now, what does that mean? I'm a sum total of a lot of things I did. Now, this stuff doesn't leave you, because when I was in Cape Town, I did this initiative called Pan-African Space Station, which was an amazing musical thing. But because of my background, I was perfectly suited, not only as an engineer, but as a musical, you know, knowing musical forms, because it drew from music from all over the world and acts from all over the world. I was perfectly suited for that position at that time. So for 5 years, I did that. And it's like, it was no sweat. It's amazing. So all I'm trying to say is that your evolution never stops. You know, and it's an evolution. There's no such thing to me as, well, I shouldn't say that. To me, you evolve. There's no, this whole thing, calling things revolution or something like that, revolution. No, you're supposed to evolve. This radio station or anything is not supposed to be the same as, you know, 50 years ago or 100 years ago. We're supposed to, radio is only 100, it's less than 100.
A little less than 100 years. Actually, about.
Yeah, because you're like 1920-something, yeah. You know. My point is,
by 1921, they're broadcasting Marian Harris. They're broadcasting a lot of gospel, a lot of religious stuff by 1921. So, yeah, I'd say it's just a tad. Now, there's a lot of stations. The question is, how many receivers were there?
Well, that's
another question.
That's another Pacifica
story. Was it yet mass media?
But that's another interesting Pacifica story. You could tell that story about, you know, when the FM out there in California, when nobody had it, they had to give out the receivers.
That's right.
That was so fun. You know, all I'm trying to say is that
they all came from Major Armstrong, yeah.
But my point is, anybody dealing in this, in specifically in community radio, or more specifically, if you are BAI, I call it, if you're a Pacifican, if you come through this experience, you're necessarily going to be broader, if you really study and whatever have you, than a bunch of other things. So your take on the world is going to be totally different than somebody who, you know, who lived there, or everywhere, you see?
Yeah.
So that's what I really enjoy my time at... my time here, I learned a lot. My time, every place I go, is because of this kind of grounding that I can keep on break borders and go beyond borders, because there are no borders. That's the whole particular point in what we, in our creativity that we could
borders
do
are a political construct.
Exactly, you know,
boundaries. They're not artistic.
Yeah, and that's what it is. We're like the coronavirus. You can't.
Oh, please. There are differences, you know, especially when one crosses great masses of water on perceptions and arts and things like that, which is why when I said the great science fiction radio dramas, there's one that's American.
Mm-hmm.
And although I have to mention the second great American producer of radio dramas, probably ZBS, that did, and this would be in your day, they did The Fourth Tower of Inverness and a lot of brilliant, funny comedy, science fiction and or noir stuff. By the way, they still exist.
Yeah, I just saw something on ZBS. I just actually, this past week, I forget what it was.
They're still doing great material. But the one in the U.S. was, as I said, the Firesign Theater. And in England, it really was Douglas Adams with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But because the Hitchhiker's Guide was, you know, never properly broadcast, because it was sneak broadcast in New York and L.A. on Pacifica.
You were,
and then it went on NPR, which really wasn't that popular.
You were a bootlegger. You was bootlegging it. Be honest.
The guy who produced and wrote it gave me these discs. Was I supposed to ask him the provenance of these? Like, did the BBC say, Douglas, get ye out? And, I mean, for years, I kept the fact that I got these discs secret. But now the man is dead for a decade.
Just remember when I went to Venice Film Festival, and I was late. I was trying to get into this thing, and the guards, they had pity on me. So they sort of, they covered their eyes and just turned away. They let me go through.
Yeah, right.
Thing. I got you. But let's go back to that.
Plausible deniability are the operative words.
Very
there.
Good. Oh, man, you get that CIA connection, I can tell. Listen, we talked about something earlier. I really want to get to this because, you know, this whole thing about PBS and, you know, I would say public radio versus.
Yeah, this is off the air, that we were talking about this.
But the thing is, I don't think people realize, and I say it's conspiracy theater, but conspiracy theory. Now, you corrected me, not corrected me, but you had a different spin on it. So let's talk about that just because I think it's important, right? Because I insist that Public Broadcasting Corporation, that came around about 1967, something like that, under Johnson.
Well, okay. There's a difference between the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and, at the time, National Educational Television, NET.
Yeah, that was out of Channel 13. We knew that in New York.
No, this was national.
Oh, okay. Well.
WNET was the New York station.
Okay.
NET was the National Educational Television, which was in I don't know how many cities, but it was in all the majors and all that. And because it was so cutting edge, and this is my opinion, not history, because it was so cutting edge and was quite willing to make fun of the donors who kept it alive, like car companies and the like, They were replaced.
Tell the story. You like to tell me. It's so good. Come on.
Well, one of the classic bits, and people can go to YouTube to see this, the recently deceased, the absolutely wonderful and emanated from WBAI, Marshall Efron, did one of his consumer pieces. He did many consumer pieces, like how do you get jumbo olives into a little can, things like that, and some very bizarre recipes. Mm-hmm. But he also did a thing on car safety. Mm-hmm. And this is in the Ralph Nader days, and this is not long after it was very clear that a certain type of car was a death trap. Mm-hmm. And he did a bit in which he was talking about car safety, and he's representing those people. And, you know, we have nothing but your safety in mind. And all the while he was talking, there was a car, you know, several yards behind him, falling apart and getting, and, you know, just using special effects and stuff, you know, and I'm talking wires and stuff when I say special effects.
Hey, audio drama, come on.
Yeah.
Say what it is.
You know, and they were just pulling the whole thing apart while he was talking, you know, straight faced as anything. Mm-hmm. And it was obviously a, you know, and then at the end of the show comes, you know, this program is brought to you with support from the Ford Foundation and Mobil Oil. Yeah, and all that. And, of course, the NET died along with The Great American Dream Machine, one of the great shows of all time, a show that introduced the world to Randy Newman and all kinds of stuff. Go to YouTube. There's surprisingly decent amount of their stuff there, although not the best. But a lot of it is there. And you can see the stuff that we are talking about there. And that is why, if we were still in fundraising mode, we would explain the difference between government radio, such as National Public Radio, which is funded mostly by Congress. Your donations go to help, but it's not their sole source. Pacifica Radio, which predates NPR and PBS by, 25 to 30 years, we are listener-sponsored. We get we don't so much get grants from CPB as if we fulfill certain things, which we have not in recent years, they will help pay some of our bills, and that comes to a lot of money. Like, for example, rights to play music on the air. That stuff don't come free. We have to thank the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for the ability to do that.
Yeah, they control the law. They made the law that we can.
No, they made a deal with the record companies. It's not the law. Okay. No, they negotiated saying to the record companies, come on, a college station? Really? You're going to ask this college station for umpteen million dollars a year where they don't even pay anybody, the station manager or something? So they came up with a thing for all non-commercial radio stations to be able to play music. For some reason, they've never been able to do it for internet. We can stream music on the internet, but you can't put it in a format that can be downloaded. So we can't just, so if you do a podcast and you play music on that podcast, you got to pay full royalties.
Yeah.
That's a problem. And CPB, for some reason, has never dealt with that issue. But they did make it possible for us to play music. Okay, that's a big deal.
Yes, it is very big.
So, you know, it's not – it is politically controlled because its funding comes from Congress. But it is not in and of itself an evil entity. But then again, that depends on – who's running it, and who appoints the chair of CPB. And that's that's a presidential appointment, by the way.
Well, there you go.
So, you know, things can change. But at any rate, the Great American Dream Machine died an ignoble death for being ballsy.
Well, guess what? You know, a lot of things are dying an ignoble death for being, you know.
You know, they just, one of my favorite TV shows just got canceled.
Oh, what's that?
The Magicians.
Oh, I don't know them.
Yeah, you seen?
I don't have TV. I don't do TV. But.
Okay, yeah, it's the only show left that I would ever watch on the sci-fi, or as I call it, the Syphy channel, or occasionally the syphilis channel.
Oh, stop.
It's the, well, it's S-Y-F-Y, you know.
Yeah.
It's the syphilis channel.
Oh, Lord.
It's the, well, let's pronounce it the way it's spelt. And it's the Syphy channel, okay?
Okay.
And this is a brilliant show. This is, some of the stuff there is genius, and I mean genius. And for some reason, it's pretty uncensored. I don't know why. The language, any rate, and the songs and stuff like that. And they don't necessarily have...
They don't have a blockbuster audience, you know, so people... See, I find, like, for instance, my YouTube channel, I do not have a lot of subscribers. I do not have a lot of followers or anything like that. But that means I don't have a lot of trolls. It means there's no, you know, and plus I'm what do you call, Creative Commons. You
but
know what I mean?
But so, sci-fi is part of NBC.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's like the it's I don't know it, but it's probably off to the side. They got bigger fish to fry off, bigger.
No, not at that channel. No, that was really? The only show left on that channel. If you're not a wrestling fan, worth watching.
Huh.
Okay. Now I haven't seen Winona Earp.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't speak to any of this stuff, but I can.
Yeah, and the point is that they had so much guts that in the fourth season they did something that was so radical, I won't talk about it because somebody might go to an archive or Netflix or something like that. And do you have Netflix?
No.
Okay. If you had Netflix, and I know you get that in South Africa.
Yeah, but I don't. Yeah,
if
I
don't. You.
I'm not a money person.
If you had it, you could see this show.
Okay.
And at the end of the fourth season of the show, there are things that people call reveals. This is a spoiler, so spoiler-filled that if people told you about it, you might never want to watch the show because it would be too devastating.
Well, I have access to Netflix in a few months. I could, you know, okay. I'll be in the States for like 5 months.
Watch The Magicians,
okay.
Based on a trilogy of novels by Lev Grossman, who lives blocks from here.
So why don't I just read the books?
Well, you should do that. But the TV series doesn't really resemble the books that much. They take the first book follows one character, and the second book follows another character. And the TV series follows both those characters and adds another three and lifts them in importance. And by the time they got to the fourth season, the first two characters who were the, quote, heroes, finger waggling on that, were not the be-all and end-all of the show. It's a very free, very smart, really smart show that has no problem with queer themes, with, you know, it doesn't know borders. It doesn't know political borders. And it's not about the magic. So many fantasy books that involve magic are about the magic. The magic is a major use and focal point, but it's about the people.
Well, let me ask you something, Jim, because this is your bailiwick here. What in the last, say, I'm just going to pick a number, 25 years, what have you, because of information, bunch of things, what have you noticed as far as writing, profound writing or something, or creativity or vision? Has it evolved?
It's gotten better.
In other words, if we look
in science fiction.
Yeah, because.
When I say science fiction, I mean science fiction, fantasy, and horror.
Okay.
I don't mean just science fiction. I mean speculative fiction, fabulous fiction, fantastic fiction. Call it what you want.
Well, I guess I'm asking about the creative mind of people right now.
Okay.
What genre of people have the most creative mind? I'm not talking about funds and stuff like that. I'm not talking like the Marvel, you know, DC. You know. I'm just talking about what's the next? What are we looking for? What can we expect?
You have to follow writers like Nora Jemison, who also lives right here. Mm-hmm. And I mean within blocks. N.K. Jemison is mm-hmm. how she is known. And she is probably, I dare say, living the most important black writer working today. Mm. That's quite a statement. But
what's her name?
N.K. Jemison, J-E-M-I-S-I-N.
Okay.
She's prolific. She's brilliant. She's been on this show maybe a dozen times and is a friend, although I don't get – now that she's such a hit, I don't get to see her that much anymore.
But
she appears at Symphony Space and sells it out, okay?
Okay.
You know, she's at that level. But more important, she is bringing a lot of multicultural thinking.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at.
To the all-white genre that is science fiction. Science fiction is born in France and England and then travels to the U.S. Mm-hmm. all in the 19th century, in the U.S. early 20th century, the 20s. There is, people who are forming the horror end of things, like H.P. Lovecraft, mm-hmm. lived in Red Hook, Brooklyn, mm-hmm. from here, referring to blacks as the mud people. Mm-hmm. You know, and these are the evil things that come out of water and mm-hmm. are here to destroy society. This is among, not the only, but among the birthing pains of the fantastic genre. Mm-hmm. Then we get to an era where it opens up, where it becomes more classic, and where we get what people call idea as hero. And by the way, one thing about Lovecraft, his writing was florid and difficult beyond belief, but his stuff was classic. Mm. He's a classic horror writer, if an aberrant human being. Then come the John W. Campbell years, and Campbell was not exactly a progressive type person, but he had an open mind about the future.
Okay.
And about the fantastic. Mm. And he helped bring about people like Asimov and Theodore Sturgeon and all that. And that's the pulp era. That's the latter part of the pulp era. We get to the digest era where we get newer ideas. But then come the 1960s with Harlan, not Ralph, Ellison, putting together books like Dangerous Visions, in which now all of a sudden writers like U.K. Le Guin become Ursula K. Le Guin, and you get publications by Joanna Russ. When I come to WBAI in 1967 as a teenager to help out, the person I'm working with is Samuel R. Delaney, a black writer who's producing radio drama for WBAI.
Really?
Stuff that is mind-blowing today. The Star Pit, a two-hour radio drama by a black science fiction writer produced 1967. Now, I made it all possible because somebody had to fetch the water. Somebody had to roll the joints.
I see.
And that was me.
It's interesting because, like, I guess in a weird sort of way, I probably should have met, I guess she's still around.
I'm positive you've met Chip Delaney.
No, I'm saying, I meant I interview a lot of people. I've never really, I'm just saying, I should have had a relationship with him, being a BA. When I say relationship,
still possible. He's around. He moved to Philly. But he can Skype, and he does travel a little. His health is not what it used to be. But he's with us, very much so.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying it's kind
of. And he's still writing.
Yeah, of course, yeah. You never stop.
Yeah, and he's one of the greatest writers in science fiction. Yes. But now, since the 90s, there's been another revolution. We're now reading Asian
Of course.
Science fiction. Mm. We're only now are we beginning to get African diaspora stories mm-hmm. turned into modern SF. There's Bienti by Nanetti. Oh, God. I hate to try to pronounce her last name.
Don't. What country?
Not sure, but her first name is spelled Nnedi. And if anybody wants to Google that, you will find out the rest. Oker. Without in front of me, I wouldn't dare pronounce it. I've eaten dinner with this woman. I can't pronounce her name. It's horrible. Yeah. Really horrible. Black science fiction is a major thing now. And multicultural science fiction in general has become what we expect in good SF. Mm-hmm. And when you take a look this year in the Hugo Awards, and the Nebula Awards, rather, the way the Academy is, every major nominee in the four categories, that's short story, novel, novella, and novelette, there was one man. Every other nominee was a woman, and many of them black.
Hmm, that's interesting.
And some Asian, Ken Liu. Ken's born here. But Ken's also doing a great deal of work bringing Asian science fiction to the U.S.
That's great. Well, look, I'm going to have to leave soon, but let me ask you one final question. I know this is your program, and I'm asking you questions, but that's what I
choose. No, that's great.
I'm currently reading I got this book. I think it was Cape Town. I was walking down the street. People said they don't have a reading culture in whatever. This book is falling apart. It only costs 10 rand.
Also, hold it up to the camera.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Frank Yerby, that's a Captain Rebel. Can't say I've heard of it.
Oh, no. Frank Yerby, I knew him from the first book he wrote that I know of was The Dahomian. If you read A Dahomian, then you read Jubilee by Margaret Walker. And then you read Miss Jane Pittman, right? Those three like that. That's black history,
uh-huh.
Up until the 60s. But Frank Yerby, he's one of my favorite writers. Now, this is what he does. He's a black writer. People don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
But after The Dahomian, right, then he started to write these kind of romance, these kind of adventure kind of things. But they're so historically accurate. Think of like... If a black person was writing about white people, if a white person was writing about black people fairly, this is what Frank Yerby does because he's black. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But going right into the Civil War, and it's got such interesting stuff that applies to today. The whole multicultural, that's everything, fairness, race, everything like that. It's amazing.
You find a lot of that in science fiction genre.
That's why I'm asking you.
Okay, and the answer to where you read this, there is one anthology that was put together by Cherie Renee Thomas. Mm-hmm. Called Dark Matter, 1990, mm-hmm. years ago at this point, but still in print, never out of print. She brought Walter Mosley to write science fiction, mm-hmm. Great mystery writer who first wrote some cruddy science fiction, but, give the man a break.
Well, you're
switching genres, now he's writing great science fiction.
Mm. I feel like... Can I tell you Walter Mosley?
Devil with a Blue Dress On is one of his.
Let me tell you about Walter Mosley.
Yeah.
When he first came out, I was reading those books before they came out. Then Matthew was getting had an interview.
Matthew Finch.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He was was in the department, and I had one rule in my department, of course, you had to read the book. So Matthew's setting up stuff in Edit B, in the meat locker, rather, and I said, well, Matthew, hey, how you doing? Let me help you a little bit. Well, who are you interviewing? He said, oh, Walter Mosley. I said, okay, great. Oh man, I know Walter because I read Devil in the Blue Dress, White something, whatever the mm-hmm. first three ones. Because this was very early on.
The mouse books, yeah.
Yeah. And he says, oh, I said, have you read the books? He says, no. I said, what the heck? What are you doing? And so I had to interview Walter Mosley, And then, but years later, when we tried to interview Walter Moore, they got to go to his people and blah, blah, blah. You know how it goes. You know, I'm like, ah, oh, man, please. You know, but that's what BAI is supposed to be.
I have Mosley's cell number. But anyway.
No, I don't mess with famous people, man.
The first event that I did here at 388 Atlantic Avenue was Walter Mosley for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readers.
So he still loves BAI. Huh, that's good.
Well, that actually wasn't a BAI event. That was my event.
Yeah.
And but no, he's still very good about being
accessible.
I'm
recorded him at Penn. I mean, I've been around.
You have to go through his people, but his people are instructed that the answer is more often than not yes, not no.
Well, anyway, but I got it. But let me just say
they're a sieve, not a gateway.
Yeah. I'm not trying to stroke you or anything like that, but you know, I respect you so much, Jim, only because of all that you've done, your history, that you remember your history.
Some of it, yeah.
And that, you know, you keep on moving, you're evolving, you keep on evolving. You have just a fount of information. And I think the next few years, the things that you have planned, we're not going to talk about it now, but I really have to stick around. So when I say stick around, just I have to keep monitering you to find out what's the next step, what's the next step.
Well,
it's always fascinating.
The issue for the – I have very definite ideas for the next steps. The problem is monetization. And to do that in a non-predatory manner.
Yes.
And a manner in which the art remains uninterrupted, true to the author and the art itself. Those are the rules.
Yeah.
However, my very next event at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will be with – I haven't announced this on the air yet – will be with Veronica Roth, who has never written anything that hasn't been a New York Times bestseller and a big movie. But this is her first novel for adults. She's written mostly YA stuff, and she has a new novel called Chosen Ones with a great premise. Okay, 5 years ago, you were the Messiah. You were the one destined to save the world, the white person who saved the ignobles from, you know, white man's burden kind of thing. What you doing now, Bunky? It's a great premise.
Yeah, well, listen, I know you do the first weekend, the first week
first
of
Tuesday of every month.
And unfortunately, I think the first year, next month, I will
April 7th.
I will be gone.
You missed. called me last night when I was in the throes.
And if you'd have just texted me, come down, I would have been there.
And it was an audio drama night, man.
I would have been there.
You should have been there.
Yeah. But anyway. But I think
Speaking of audio drama, I got to play Hitchhikers. We're out of time.
That's why I'm leaving.
That's half an hour.
But I'll be back, I think, from – I'll probably
– We're going to use that platform, New York Review Science Fiction Readings, that you and I are going to collaborate in an event there. My initial thought are African folk tales, dramatized or just told properly.
Come on. We got to audio drama. No, you're not telling nothing.
And by the way, I should point out, it's, you know, given Tundi and all the cameras that we have down there.
We're going to work it.
It's for TV.
Yeah.
Think of it as a TV show.
Thank you so much for having me, man.
Thank you. Now, I got a question for the audience and for you. Now, there are six episodes, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, for the original. Mm. Episode 4 is the episode about 42, this being the 42nd anniversary. Yeah. But I play episodes 3 and 4 a lot because they're my favorite. Yeah. But episode 1 really gives the flavor of the thing.
So
maybe I should, for a change.
That's no question. Just go and do it.
Okay. So if you were listening earlier, you heard the whole story of how I was the first person in the U.S. to broadcast what you are about to hear. And I'm sure I won't be the last, but sit ye back to the music of the Eagles, the voices of Simon Jones, and many wonderful actors for the original, before there was a book, before there was a TV series, before there was a movie, and before there was a play. This thing has gone far. You've heard the name.
Yeah, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
So enjoy it.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. starring Peter Jones as the Book, with Simon Jones and Jeffrey McGiven. This is the story of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, perhaps the most remarkable, certainly the most successful book ever to come out of the great publishing corporations of Ursa Minor. More popular than the Celestial Home Care Omnibus, better selling than 53 More Things to Do in Zero Gravity, and more controversial than Ulan Khaloufid's trilogy of philosophical blockbusters, Where God Went Wrong, Some More of God's Greatest Mistakes, and Who Is This God Person Anyway? And in many of the more relaxed civilizations on the outer eastern rim of the galaxy, The Hitchhiker's Guide has already supplanted the great Encyclopedia Galactica as the standard repository of all knowledge and wisdom, because although it has many omissions, contains much that is apocryphal, or at least wildly inaccurate, it scores over the older, more pedestrian work in two important ways. First, it is slightly cheaper, and second, it has the words "Don't Panic" inscribed in large, friendly letters on the cover. To tell the story of the book, it's best to tell the story of some of the minds behind it. A human, from the planet Earth, was one of them, though as our story opens, he no more knows his destiny than a tea leaf knows the history of the East India Company. His name is Arthur Dent. He is a 6-foot-tall ape descendant, and someone is trying to drive a bypass through his home.
Come off it, Mr. Dent. You can't win, you know. Look, there's no point in lying down in the path of progress.
I've gone off the idea of progress. It's overrated.
But you must realise that you can't lie in front of the bulldozers indefinitely.
I'm game. We'll see who rusts first.
I'm afraid you're going to have to accept it. This bypass has got to be built, and it is going to be built. Nothing you can say or do...
Why has it got to be built?
What do you mean, why has it got to be built? It is a bypass. You've got to build bypasses.
Didn't anyone consider the alternative?
There aren't any alternatives. Look, you were quite in time to make any suggestions or protests at the appropriate time.
Appropriate time?
Yes.
The first I knew about it was when a workman arrived at the door yesterday.
Oh.
I asked him if he'd come to clean the windows, and he said he'd come to demolish the house. He didn't tell me straight away, of course. No. First he wiped a couple of windows and charged me a fiver. Then he told me...
But, Mr. Dent, the plans have been available in the planning office for the last 9 months.
Yes. I went round to find them yesterday afternoon. You hadn't exactly gone out of your way to call much attention to them, had you? I mean, like actually telling anybody or anything.
The plans were on display.
And how many average members of the public are in the habit of casually dropping around at the local planning office of an evening? It's not exactly a noted social venue, is it? And even if you had popped in on the off chance that some raving bureaucrat wanted to knock your house down, the plans weren't immediately obvious to the eye, were they?
That depends where you were looking.
I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights had probably gone.
So had the stairs.
Well, you found the notice, didn't you?
Yes. It was on display in the bottom of a locked filing cabinet, stuck in a disused lavatory with a sign on the door saying, "Beware of the leopard." Ever thought of going into advertising?
It's not as if it's a particularly nice house, anyway.
I happen rather to like it.
Mr. Dent!
Yes, hello.
Have you any idea how much damage that bulldozer would suffer if I just let it roll straight over you?
How much?
None at all.
By a strange coincidence, none at all is exactly how much suspicion the ape descendant Arthur Dent had that one of his closest friends was not descended from an ape, but was in fact from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse. Arthur Dent's failure to suspect this reflects the care with which his friend blended himself into human society, after a fairly shaky start. When he first arrived 15 years ago, the minimal research he had done suggested to him that the name Ford Prefect would be nicely and conspicuous. He will enter our story in 35 seconds and say, "Hello, Arthur." The ape descendant will greet him in return, but in deference to a million years of evolution, he will not attempt to pick fleas off him. Earthmen are not proud of their ancestors and never invite them round to dinner.
Hello, Arthur. Arthur?
Ford, hi, how are you?
Fine, look, are you busy?
Well, I've just got this bulldozer to lie in front of, otherwise... No, not especially.
There's a pub down the road. Let's have a drink and we can talk.
Don't you understand?
Mr. Dent, we're waiting!
Ford, that man wants to knock my house down.
Well, he can do it whilst you're away, can't he?
But I don't want him to.
Well, just ask him to wait till you get back.
Ford!
Arthur! Will you please just listen to me? I'm not fooling. I've got to tell you the most important thing you've ever heard. I've got to tell you now, and I've got to tell you in that pub there.
Why?
Because you're going to need a very stiff drink. Now just trust me.
I'll see what I can do. It had better be good. Hello, Mr. Prosser?
Yes, Mr. Dent. Have you come to your senses yet?
Well, can we just assume for a moment that I haven't?
Well...
And that I'm going to be staying put here till you go away.
So?
So you're going to be standing around all day doing nothing.
Could be.
Well, if you're resigned to standing around doing nothing all day, you don't actually need me here all the time, do you?
No. Not as such.
So if you can just take it as read that I'm actually here, I could just slip off down to the pub for half an hour. How does that sound?
That sounds, Oh, very reasonable, I think, Mr. Dent. I'm sure we don't actually need you there for the whole time. We can just hold up our end of the confrontation.
And if you want to pop off for a bit later on, I can always cover for you in return.
Oh, thank you. Yes, yes, oh, that'll be fine. Yes, very kind of you, Mr. Dent, very kind.
And, of course, it goes without saying that you don't try and knock my house over while I'm away.
Oh, what? Good Lord! No, Mr. Dent.
Do you think we can trust him?
Myself, I'd trust him to the end of the earth.
Yes, but how far's that?
About 12 minutes away. Come on, I need a drink.
By drink, Ford Prefect meant alcohol. The Encyclopaedia Galactica describes alcohol as a colourless, volatile liquid formed by the fermentation of sugars, and also notes its intoxicating effect on certain carbon-based life forms. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy also mentions alcohol. It says that the best drink in existence is the Pan-Galactic Gargle Blaster, the effect of which is like having your brain smashed out with a slice of lemon wrapped round a large gold brick. The guide also tells you on which planets the best Pan-Galactic Gargle Blasters are mixed, how much you can expect to pay for one, and what voluntary organizations exist to help you rehabilitate.
6 pints of bitter, and quickly, please, the world's about to end.
Oh, yes, sir. Nice weather for it. Going to watch the match this afternoon, sir?
No, no point.
Foregone conclusion, you reckon, sir? Arsenal without a chance?
No, it's just that the world's going to end.
Oh, yes, sir, you said. Lucky escape for Arsenal if it did.
No, not really.
There you are, sir. 6 points.
Keep the change.
What, from a fiver? Thank you, sir.
You've got 10 minutes left to spend it.
Ford, would you please tell me what the hell is going on?
Drink up, you've got 3 pints to get through.
3 at lunchtime?
Time is an illusion. Lunchtime doubly so. Oh,
very deep. You should send that into the Reader's Digest. They've got a page for people like you.
Drink up?
Why 3 pints?
Muscle relaxant. You'll need it.
Did I do something wrong today, or has the world always been like this and I've been too wrapped up in myself to notice?
All right, I'll try to explain. How long have we known each other, Arthur?
Oh, 5 years, maybe 6. Most of it seemed to make some kind of sense at the time.
All right. How would you react if I said that I'm not from Guildford after all, but from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse?
I don't know. Why, do you think it's the sort of thing you're likely to say?
Drink up, the world's about to end.
This must be Thursday. I never could get the hang of Thursdays.
On this particular Thursday, something was moving quietly through the ionosphere miles above the surface of the planet. But few people on the surface of the planet were aware of it. One of the 6,000 million people who hadn't glanced into the ionosphere recently was called Lady Cynthia Fitzmilton. She was, at that moment, standing in front of Arthur Dent's house in Cottington. Many of those listening to her speech would probably have experienced great satisfaction to know that in 4 minutes' time she would evaporate into a whiff of hydrogen, ozone and carbon monoxide. However, when the moment came, they would hardly notice because they would be too busy evaporating themselves.
I have been asked to come here to say a few words to mark the beginning of work on the very splendid and worthwhile New Bedingford Bypass.
Get off!
And I must say immediately... immediately. What a great honor and a great privilege I think it must be for you, the people of Cottington, to have this gleaming new motorway going through your cruddy little village. I'm sorry, your little country village of cruddy Cottington. I know how proud you must feel at this moment to know your obscure and unsung hamlet will now arise reborn as the very splendid and worthwhile Cottington Service Station. Providing welcome refreshment and sanitary relief for every weary traveller on his way.
Why don't you push off, you country so bad?
It gives me great pleasure to take this bottle of very splendid and worthwhile champagne and break it against the noble prow of this very splendid and worthwhile yellow bulldozer.
They haven't started yet.
Oh, good.
It's probably just your house being knocked down.
What?
It hardly makes any difference at this stage.
My God, it is! What the hell are they doing? We had an agreement.
Let them have their fun.
Damn you and your fairy stories. They're smashing up my home. Stop, you vandals! You home wreckers! You half-faced Visigoths! Stop!
Arthur, come back! It's pointless. Hell, I'd better go after him. Barman, quickly, can you just give me 4 packets of peanuts?
Certainly, sir. There you are. 28 pence.
Keep the change.
Are you serious, sir? I mean, do you really think the world's going to end this afternoon?
Yes, in just over 1 minute and 35 seconds.
Well, isn't there anything we can do?
No, nothing.
Well, I always thought we were meant to lie down or put a paper bag over our head or something.
If you like, yes.
Well, would that help?
No. Excuse me, I've got to find my friend.
Oh, well then. Last orders, please.
You pinstripe barbarians, I'll sue the councils for every penny it's got. I'll have you hung and drawn and quartered and whipped and boiled, and then I'll chop you up into little bits until you've had enough.
Arthur, don't bother. There isn't time. Get over here. There's only 10 seconds left.
And then I'll do it some more. And when I finish, I'll take all the little bits and I'll jump on them. And I'll carry on jumping on them until I get blisters. Or I can think of something even more unpleasant to do. And then I'll... What the hell's that?
Arthur, quick, over here.
But what the hell is it?
It's a fleet of flying saucers. What do you think it is? Quick, you've got to get hold of this rod.
What do you mean, flying saucers?
Just that. It's a Vogon constructor fleet.
A what?
A Vogon constructor fleet. I picked up news of their arrival a few hours ago on my sub-ether radio.
Ford, I don't think I can cope with any more of this. I think I'll just go and have a little lie down somewhere.
No, just stay here. Keep calm. And just take hold of this...
People of Earth, your attention, please. This is Prosthetic Vogon Jokes of the Galactic Hyperspace Planning Council. As you will no doubt be aware, the plans for the development of the outlying regions of the western spiral arm of the galaxy require the building of a hyperspace express route through your star system. And, regrettably, your planet is one of those scheduled for demolition. The process will take slightly less than 2 of your Earth minutes. Thank you very much. There's no point in acting all surprised about it. All the planning charts and demolition orders have been on display at your local planning department in Alpha Centauri for 50 of your Earth years, so you've had plenty of time to lodge any formal complaints, and it's far too late to start making a fuss about it now. What do you mean you've never been to Alpha Centauri? Oh, for heaven's sake, mankind, it's only 4 light years away, you know. I'm sorry, but if you can't be bothered to take an interest in local affairs, that's your own lookout. Energize the demolition beams. God, I don't know, apathetic bloody planet, I've no sympathy at all.
Thank you.
bought some peanuts.
What?
If you've never been through a matter transference beam before, you've probably lost some salt and protein. The beer you had should have cushioned your system a bit. How are you feeling?
Like a military academy. Bits of me keep on passing out. If I asked you where the hell we were, would I regret it?
We're safe.
Oh, good.
We're in a small galley cabin in one of the spaceships of the Vogon Constructor Fleet.
Ah, this is obviously some strange usage of the word safe that I wasn't previously aware of.
I'll have a look for the light.
All right. How did we get here?
We hitched a lift.
Excuse me, are you trying to tell me that we just stuck out our thumbs and some bug-eyed monster stuck his head out and said, "Hi, fellas, hop right in. I can take you as far as the Basingstoke roundabout."
Well, the thumb's an electronic sub-ether device. The roundabout's at Barnard Star, 6 light-years away. But otherwise, that's more or less right.
And the bug-eyed monster?
It's green, yes.
Fine. When can I go home?
You can't. Ah, I found the light.
Good grief. Is this really the interior of a flying saucer?
It certainly is. What do you think?
Well, it's a bit squalid, isn't it?
What did you expect?
Well, I don't know. Gleaming control panels, flashing lights, computer screens. Not old mattresses.
These are the Dentressi sleeping quarters.
I thought you said they were called Vogons or something.
The Vogons run the ship. The Dentressi are the cooks. They let us on board.
I'm confused.
Here, have a look at this.
What is it?
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's a sort of electronic book. It'll tell you everything you want to know. That's its job.
I like the cover. Don't panic. It's the first helpful or intelligible thing anybody said to me all day.
That's why it sells so well. Here, press this button and the screen will give you the index. You've got several million entries, so fast wind through the index to V. There you are, Vogon Constructor Fleets. Enter that code on the tabulator and read what it says.
Vogon Constructor Fleets. Here is what to do if you want to get a lift from a Vogon. Forget it. They're one of the most unpleasant races in the galaxy. Not actually evil, but bad-tempered, bureaucratic, vicious, and callous. They wouldn't even lift a finger to save their own grandmothers from the ravenous bug-bladder beast of Tral. Without orders signed in triplicate, sent in, sent back, queried, lost, found, subjected to public inquiry, lost again, and finally buried in soft peat for 3 months and recycled as firelighters. The best way to get a drink out of a Vogon is stick your finger down his throat. And the best way to irritate him is to feed his grandmother to the ravenous bug-bladder beast of Tral.
What a strange book. How did we get a lift, then?
Well, that's the point. It's out of date now. I'm doing the field research for the new revised edition of the guide. So, for instance, I will have to include a revision pointing out that since the Vogons have made so much money being professionally unpleasant, they can now afford to employ Dentressi cooks, which gives us a rather useful little loophole.
Who are the Dentressi?
The best cooks and the best drinks mixers, and they don't give a wet slap about anything else. And they will always help hitchhikers on board, partly because they like the company, but mostly because it annoys the Vogons. Which is exactly the sort of thing you need to know if you're an impoverished hitchhiker trying to see the marvels of the galaxy for less than 30 Altarian dollars a day. And that's my job. Fun, isn't it?
It's amazing.
Unfortunately, I got stuck on the Earth for rather longer than I intended. I came for a week and was stranded for 15 years.
But how did you get there in the first place?
Oh, easy. I got a lift with a teaser. You don't know what a teaser is. I'll tell you. Teasers are usually rich kids with nothing to do. They cruise around looking for planets which haven't made interstellar contact yet and buzz them.
Oh, buzz them?
Yet, they find some isolated spot with very few people around, then land right by some poor unsuspecting soul whom no one's ever going to believe, and then strut up and down in front of him wearing silly antennae on their head and making beep-beep noises. Rather childish, really.
Ford, I don't know if this sounds like a silly question, but what am I doing here?
Well, you know that. I rescued you from the Earth.
And what has happened to the Earth?
It's been disintegrated.
Has it?
Yes, it just boiled away into space.
Look, I'm a bit upset about that.
Yes, I can understand.
So, what do I do?
You come along with me and enjoy yourself. You'll need to have this fish in your ear.
I beg your pardon? What the devil's that?
Listen, it might be important.
What?
It's the Vogon captain making an announcement on the PA.
But I can't speak Vogon.
You don't need to. Just put the fish in your ear. Come on, it's only a little one.
Patrick, have a good time. Message repeat. This is your captain speaking, so stop whatever you're doing and pay attention. First of all, I see from our instruments that we have a couple of hitchhikers aboard our ship. Hello, wherever you are. I just want to make it totally clear that you are not at all welcome. I worked hard to get where I am today, and I didn't become captain of a Vogon construction ship simply so that I could turn it into a taxi service for degenerate freeloaders. I have sent out a search party, and as soon as they find you, I will put you off the ship. If you're very lucky, I might read you some of my poetry first. Secondly, we are about to jump into hyperspace for the journey to Barnard Star. On arrival, we will stay in dock for a 72-hour refit, and no one's to leave the ship during that time. I repeat, all planet leave is cancelled. I've just had an unhappy love affair, so I don't see why anyone else should have a good time. Messy James.
Charming, these Vogons. I wish I had a daughter so I could forbid her to marry one.
You wouldn't need to. They've got as much sex appeal as a road accident. And you better be prepared for the jump into hyperspace. It's unpleasantly like being drunk.
Well, what's so unpleasant about being drunk?
You ask a glass of water.
Ford?
Yes?
What's this fish doing in my ear?
Translating for you. Look under Babel Fish in the book.
What's happening?
We're going to hyperspace.
I'll never be called to return home again.
The Babel fish is small, yellow, leech-like, and probably the oddest thing in the universe. It feeds on brainwave energy, absorbing all unconscious frequencies and then excreting telepathically a matrix formed from the conscious frequencies and nerve signals picked up from the speech centers of the brain. The practical upshot of which is that if you stick one in your ear, you can instantly understand anything said to you in any form of language. The speech you hear decodes the brainwave matrix. Now, it is such a bizarrely improbable coincidence that anything so mind-bogglingly useful could evolve purely by chance that some thinkers have chosen to see it as a final clinching proof of the non-existence of God. The argument goes something like this. I refuse to prove that I exist, says God, for proof denies faith, and without faith I'm nothing. But, said man, the Babel fish is a dead giveaway, isn't it? It proves you exist, and so therefore you don't. QED. Oh dear, says God, I hadn't thought of that, and promptly vanishes in a puff of logic. Oh, that was easy, says man, and for an encore he proves that black is white and gets killed on the next zebra crossing. Most leading theologians claim that this argument is a load of dingo's kidneys, but that didn't stop Ulan Kalufid making a small fortune when he used it as the central theme of his best-selling book, Well, That About Wraps It Up for God. Meanwhile, the poor Babel fish, by effectively removing all barriers to communication between different cultures and races, has caused more and bloodier wars than anything else in the history of creation.
What an extraordinary book.
Help me write the new edition.
No, I want to go back to Earth again, I'm afraid, or its nearest equivalent.
You're turning down 100 billion new worlds to explore.
Did you get much useful material on Earth?
I was able to extend the entry, yes.
Now, let's see what it says in this edition, then.
Okay.
Let's see. E. Earth. Tap out the code. There's the page. It doesn't seem to have an entry.
Yes, it does. See, right there at the bottom of the screen, just under Eccentrica Galumbitz, the triple-breasted whore of Eroticon 6.
What, there? Oh, yes.
Harmless.
Harmless? Is that all it's got to say? One word? Harmless? What the hell's that supposed to mean?
Well, there are 100 billion stars in the galaxy and a limited amount of space in the book. And no one knew much about the Earth, of course.
Well, I hope you've managed to rectify that a little.
Yes, I transmitted a new entry off to the editor. He had to trim it a bit, but it's still an improvement.
What does it say now?
Mostly harmless.
Mostly harmless?
Well, that's the way it is. We're on a different scale now.
Okay, Ford, I'm with you. I'm bloody well coming with you. Where are we now?
Not far from Barnard's Star. It's a beautiful place, and a sort of hyperspace junction. You can get virtually anywhere from there. That is, assuming that we actually get there.
What's that?
Well, if we're lucky, it's just the Vogons come to throw us into space.
And if we're unlucky?
If we're unlucky, the captain might want to read us some of his poetry first.
Vogon poetry is, of course, the third worst in the universe. The second worst is that of the Asgoths of Kriya. During a recitation by their poet-master Grunthas the Flatulent of his poem owed to a small lump of green putty I found in my armpit one midsummer morning, four of his audience died of internal hemorrhaging, and the president of the Mid-Galactic Art Snobbling Council survived by gnawing one of his own legs off. Granthos is reported to have been disappointed by the poem's reception and was about to embark on a reading of his 12-book epic entitled My Favorite Bathtime Gurgles when his own major intestine, in a desperate attempt to save humanity, leapt straight up through his neck and throttled his brain. The very worst poetry of all perished along with its creator, Paul Neil Milne Johnston of Redbridge, in the destruction of the planet Earth. Vogon poetry is mild by comparison, and when the Vogon captain began to read, it provoked this reaction from Ford Prefect. And this from Arthur Dent.
Friend Grant Buckley, thy micturations are to me as plurdled rabble-botches in a lurking bee. Group, I implore thee, my footing turling drones, and hoopsiously drangle me with crinkly bindle wordles, for otherwise I will rend thee the gobble wards with my blurdle crunch, see if I don't. So, earthlings, I present you with a simple choice. I was going to throw you straight out into the empty blackness of space to die horribly and slowly, but there is one way, one simple way, in which you may save yourselves. Now think very carefully. If you hold your very lives in your hands. Now choose. Either die into the vacuum of space, or... Tell me how good you thought my poem was.
Will our heroes survive this terrible ordeal? Can they win through with their integrity unscathed? Can they escape without completely compromising their honour and artistic judgment? Tune in next week for the next exciting instalment of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
In that episode of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Peter Jones starred as the Book, Simon Jones was Arthur Dent, and Jeffrey McGiven, Ford Prefect. Bill Wallace was Prosser and the Fogon Captain, with Joe Kendall as Lady Cynthia Fitzmelton and David Goodison as the Barman. The programme was written by Douglas Adams and produced by Simon Brett, with the assistance of Paddy Kingsland at the Radiophonic Workshop and a small furry creature from the Crab Nebula.
It was really particularly effective in the metaphysical part.
Well, I was going to go directly into my outro music. I'm already running about a minute and 30 seconds over, but it's been moved on the computer. I can't find it. I should have looked for it earlier, but it's not there. So Lister is here. And he's going to have to come in and just start playing his outro. Lister, if you hear me, come on in. It's your airtime. I don't have my outro. But I hope that you enjoyed listening to episode one of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This is what it was before there was a book. Hey, Lister, I can't find my outro. So we're going to have to start with your intro whenever you're ready.
Oh, take your time.
I'm done.
Oh, okay.
I'm done. So I'm overdone. Overripe, for that matter. So this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next week with a writer by the name of Andrew Sayre, S-A-Y-R-E, and that's definitely going to be an excellent show. I would like to thank Anthony Sloan for being here. This is probably his one appearance on the show. He goes back to South Africa April Fool's Day, but he will be back in the U.S., for about 6 months come the summer. So we're going to have to figure out some conspiracies to get him back on our air. If you'd like to write me, look at Facebook. I've got several pages on Facebook, but I encourage you to join the Hour of the Wolf group or just, you know, message me on Facebook. Better yet, I prefer email. Write me Jim, J-I-M, at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. So the next time somebody says, oh, yes, I know the original to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, say, oh, and where did you listen to it? Not what bookshelf did you put it on? Because that was a radio show. The book is a novelization. And maybe around Towel Day, when we play more episodes, including episodes 3 and 4, which explain the importance of the number 42, maybe at that point we will be able to... which is the carts here? Which is your CD player? There we go. Okay, so we'll play more episodes in May, come Towel Day, and then you will learn the secret of life, the universe, and everything. Until then, have a wonderful week. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn. Clapper coming your way right now with Lister. And talk to you next week. Have a good morning. Captain America, too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria, trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they still have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
and never will. Brownsville, boogie down South Bronx, yeah. My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. The free book. This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Thank you very much, Jim Fry. 99 Sinker, let's still live right here, back on the air, where we belong. Jim Fry back next week, same place, same time, right here, at your favorite radio station. 8 minutes after 3 o'clock, right burning time. Dead man walking, dead man running. Joe Biden. These Negroes doing all the things they can do against their best interests. No wonder we had to call the ship Burn Baby Burn. Jim Fry next week, same place, same time, right here at your favorite 99 Sinkhole Listener Line.
Yeah.